Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg.
Hey everybody, this is Greg with the Brothers Wiss number 85. 85. I missed the last one. Actually, this one's probably going to get published before 84. You guys can thank Mike for that one. Everybody sent him a note saying, where's 84? But today we have Thomas Kurnack. No,
hello,
you can
everyone.
Just see his little thumbnail. That's all you get today.
Hello.
All right, so let's get the sponsorship out of the way. Pennytone is still sponsoring us. It's the easy button for deploying VoIP services to your business customers. They provide all the features you expect with the reliability and care you deserve. Sounds like an underwear commercial. But he's got a special going this month that's $10 per extension per month, which is actually pretty darn good. You can visit him over at www.pennytone.com or 855-PENNYTONE. I don't know who wants to call anymore. I would rather go to a website or an email. I don't like people. I don't like humans. As Thomas will protest, they give you the flu.
Well, yeah, they do.
All right. So let's jump right in. We're going to talk about your flu acquisition in a second. There was an announcement. So before, somebody was musing that Intel was sniffing around to buy Mellanox, but it turns out NVIDIA actually picked them up. You think this means anything different than if Intel picked them up?
It's certainly going to be interesting seeing what happens in the coming months or years with Mellanox and all the IP that they own. I mean, Andrew would probably be able to talk much more regarding the chip side and the IP side that Mellanox owns and all the previous acquisitions and the history of everything that Mellanox owns at this point. But so supposedly, NVIDIA acquired them for the high-speed networking stuff for HPC, high-performance computing. And yeah, that's their angle. Like, pretty much every workload, every supercomputer today runs GP compute, right? And so NVIDIA has hands in the data center game, and certainly networking and high-speed networking especially is very important for these academic and other workloads that you run on GP compute. So supposedly that's their motivation for acquiring Mellanox, and yeah, we'll see what comes out of it.
That's interesting. Yeah, and so I guess the reason we're talking about it is the Tilera chipset is what, four companies deep inside of Mellanox, like four acquisitions deep at this point?
Yeah, four acquisitions, and of course, the IDE or the development packages, there is an exact name, which I don't know. Again, we really need to get Andrew Triff to talk about this. And yeah, so that is not supported anymore either. So it will be interesting.
Yeah, what does that mean? Interesting. And so as you guys know, the Tilera chipset's what's in most of the CCR stuff, right?
Exactly.
Those multi-core chips. So speaking of MikroTik, while we're at it, the EU MUM, that just happened. You were just there. You just brought home a souvenir in the form of a virus. How was it?
Yeah, so other than getting a flu at the EU MUM, there was a lot of people. So this was the biggest EU MUM to date. There were, I think, almost 1,700 people. So quite big. And there were some new product announcements, which I suppose we can talk about as well. And yeah, it was big. That's all I can say.
Did you have any groupies? Anybody walk up and say, hey, I know you?
So thank you to everyone that actually said hi, and thank you to everyone that mentioned they listened to the podcast. I was really happy to see and then hear all those people. That was surprisingly, there were surprisingly a lot of you. So thanks again.
That's cool. We seem to be, and I'm sure this is more a product of my ignorance, underrepresented over in Europe. I think as soon as we put Tom Smith on, it just turned everybody over there off. That's what it was.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for turning off all our audience. Is that what we are saying?
That's the joke part. You can laugh at that. That was a joke. I think you took that one serious. No, no, no.
No, I know where you were going with this.
No, they did announce some new stuff, and I guess kind of rebranded some stuff that they had previous. I don't know. So there's this Switch. It's a CRS-326-24S Plus 2Q Plus, and they said it was previously announced as the CRS-332-32S. I guess they changed the amount of ports and things like that on it. So this is going to be 24 SFP Plus with 2Q SFP Plus ports. And they're saying that's going to be quarter three of 2019. So
hopefully the timelines, they actually stick to the timelines this time.
Yeah. The fact that they've announced it and then changed the hardware and then re-announced it's kind of not a great sign, but...
Well, manufacturing and especially at-scale manufacturing products like this is not easy. And what was interesting is that MikroTik specifically made a point at the month to mention that they do completely everything in-house, you know, from design through, obviously, of writing router as itself through manufacturing, distribution, and everything else. So, timelines slip and manufacturing products at scale is not easy. So, at one side, I understand MikroTik. At the other side, you know, I want my new hardware.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, too, I guess thinking about it, MikroTik, in the grand scheme of things, is a small company. And if they see the market shift, they see a change, well, then they can, I guess, kind of quickly pivot and redesign and then get it out there. That's kind of cool.
And I think that's actually very much what is happening right now, especially considering all of the new products that were announced at this month. I personally was very surprised to see where MikroTik is going right now. And if they see that hole in the market, or if they think they can capitalize on it, then all I can say is I wasn't expecting most of these products, so we'll see what keeps on coming from MikroTik.
I don't know that anybody was expecting a lot of these products. You've also got, they've been developing more and more switches, and it looks like they're density-wise, they're finally starting to get closer to that 48 port, the 24 and 48 porters, but they have one here that's a CRS-312. I don't feel like reading out the whole name. It's basically 10 gig copper Ethernet ports, and then 4 10 gig/SFP Plus combo ports. Do you have a lot of kit that uses copper 10 gig stuff?
Quite a bit, yeah. And actually, I'm looking really forward to this particular switch because it's dual PSU and it's MikroTik, so it will be extremely cheap. Sorry, excuse me.
I'm guessing you're coughing right there.
Yeah, that was me muting my mic. Sorry.
No worries.
We've got all of our servers are connected through 10 gig copper. All of our SAN storage area network and all of that, like everything that's compute and storage within our racks is 10 gig copper. Now, of course, that might not be that interesting to our usual listeners, but these switches and MikroTik itself, maybe some of you listening have noticed, has been getting a lot of press lately in enterprise and not even enterprise, but like mid-size server groups and storage groups, etc., particularly Serve the Home, which is a really good and big website that deals with, you know, cheaper and enterprise-grade stuff, has been covering a lot of MikroTik lately. So I think these switches will sell really well.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. I like the addition of the SFP Plus combo ports as well, so you can kind of connect in the rest of your infrastructure with it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And like, then, go ahead.
For us, up to this point, it's been really hard to find cheap, fully managed 10 gig switches, right? Their price class is somewhere completely else. And you know, us being in Slovakia and us not having the unlimited budget, up to now we've been using refurb gear, so I look forward to this because it's CRS3 series, which means, you know, all the nice switching stuff we want is in hardware. And yeah, I think, like I said, these will sell really well.
Yeah, and even then, you mentioned using some gray market kit. Your gray market in Slovakia is not the same as my gray market here in the U.S. I mean, we have so much, say, third-party Cisco and Juniper kit we can just grab off of eBay, and that's not really a luxury you have, right?
Oh, no. For us, we have to bring them from UK or Germany because, yeah, in Slovakia, people just don't use these. It's, you know, it's our requirements are, well, at least my personally, but the enterprise requirements are pretty much the same. There is just, you know, so much less enterprises and people that would use this gear that really there is no secondhand market locally, and yeah, we have to import.
Yeah, well, I mean, the price of these brand new MikroTik switches coupled with their lower power utilization, I mean, they're going to kick the butt off of, say, 5-year-old Cisco kit as far as power goes. Not that they're, even the Cisco stuff's not like it's consuming a lot, but I mean, it's a difference.
Definitely. And luckily, we are also seeing now MikroTik catching up in features. You know, I think if you remember, like 2 or 3 years ago, I was bashing at MikroTik pretty hard for, you know, I have certain requirements to which a switch must comply with in order for me to deploy it anywhere. And I'm happy to say MikroTik has been really decently moving towards filling out all of those checkboxes. So it's really nice for them to see work on the CRS series, to see that they haven't abandoned it. They are working on it. And like at every MOM I talk with them and, you know, tell them it still needs this and that and you can improve here and there. And they actually listen and they actually act on that feedback, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, they're getting there slow and steady. I mean, they're mounting that hill, which I'm excited about. So the CRS 354 48G, so that's a 48 copper gig port, 4 SFP plus port, 2 QSFP plus ports, which we had talked about before. The QSFP plus, like from carriers and things like that, I don't really see that much anymore. People were suggesting that was probably a limitation of the chipsets they're using in there, instead of going straight to 100 gig, doing the QSFP plus stuff. So that is a really packed switch. They're even saying that they're going to do a PoE out version of that 48 port switch, expected Q4 of this year.
So this is the same switch that was basically announced last year and announced for Q4 2018. So here we can see that, you know, little problem with delivering the product, which again is understandable.
Yeah.
Especially this is a really new class of switches for MikroTik. So I just really hope that they deliver it on time because, of course, I want to see the pricing on it. But if the pricing is good, we will deploy a lot of these switches.
And I wish I could see, yeah, which we would never be able to see. But I wish I could see the sales statistics for the various switch lines, you know, like, you know, just to see the numbers kind of year over year. Are they growing? Are they stagnating? You know, I mean, I'm assuming since they're pumping out more and more switches, that must be a really growing segment of their kit.
But I would assume so, but yeah, it's hard to say. What I hear from distributors right now is that there is serious demand from the for the HAP series, you know, HAP AC and other HAPs, what used to be 951s, etc.
Yeah.
And MikroTik has supply issues even on that side. In particular, one distributor was telling me that they ordered 1,200 HAPs in December, and it's March, and they still haven't received them. And that's, you know, 1,200 HAPs. That's a serious size order, and supposedly, you know, waiting 3 months for that. So here, though, on the HAP side of things, I don't think it's MikroTik. I think it's just chip supply issues. And I've been hearing people mentioning that a lot. So, you know, when you combine chip supply issues, when you combine logistics and product development issues, etc., I think MikroTik is really successful, and we can obviously see that from the proliferation of MikroTiks around the world lately and the related exploits and attacks against MikroTiks that come with that, which I think 2 or 3 years ago, nobody even seriously would think about doing large-scale MikroTiks attacks because MikroTik was simply not that well-known. But yes, there were many MikroTiks deployed, and you know, they were a niche product for a niche industry, but today, just 2 or 3 years later, they are in a very different spot, and they, you know, it's so I think MikroTik has been growing, and it's certainly getting known by more people, and there is supply issues that are related to that.
Yeah, growing pains. It's I guess that's a sign of health for a company, which is great. I think they need some North American ambassadors, you know, maybe ones that run podcasts or something like that, that they would want to get on board and help them out with some of that stuff.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a good plan.
Slovakian ambassador, I think, would maybe be pretty good too.
Hey, we are a Slavic country as well. It's like there is almost no closer you can get than that. So anyway.
All right. So I want to get to the probably the most controversial announcement. I'm sure you can guess what I'm fixing to say. It's the GPIN stuff, Gigabit Passive Ethernet Network. So this is sort of their spin on GPON, right? So GPON is Gigabit Passive Optical Network. So it's kind of the fiber to the home stuff. This is GPIN, which they're sort of theoretically emulating the same thing, but you're just doing it with copper. So this is going to be more kind of a MDU play, I guess, right?
So for me, it's really hard to say. I can certainly see different use cases for this, but also I can see problems with it and why you would not want to use it. But that's me. So the rumors or the talk at the Mumber, and this is, none of this is confirmed, so I don't know if this is true or not, but the rumors were that this is pretty much almost entirely for the Brazilian region, the Indonesian region, and the Asian/Oceanic regions, and there is high demand in those regions for this kind of solution. Although, as I said, most of us in Europe and US would probably have quite harsh opinions about this product, because if you are pulling something, why just not pull fiber? But if MikroTik, certainly this product has to have come from somewhere, you know, from some demand, from some requests. And so, the rumors are it's those regions that I mentioned previously that MikroTik is planning to mostly ship this for.
All right, so let's look at the gear associated with this. They announced 3 switches that look like all outdoor. I mean, it looks like they even have pole mounts on the back of these switches, and they're all 6, well, 2 of them are 16 port, 1 of them is an 8 port. They're very interesting. One of them is 16 Ethernet ports with 2 SFP uplinks, and it's got reverse PoE on 15 of the ports, which means the client has the capability. So all of the client connections will reverse PoE. They'll inject power towards the switch. And I was watching the MUM presentation, and they said, well, odds are one of your clients will still have power in a brownout, and so he will be able to power your switch for you, which I think is very interesting.
Well, also, you know, if somebody wants internet, they will have to have power to their equipment, which means that if nobody is using internet, the main switch being off or not receiving power doesn't even matter. And as soon as somebody wants to access the network, you know, they will power the switch. And yeah, for me, what is interesting is, what I don't know if would fly here, is that you are basically taking electricity from the client, and how do you properly legalize and, you know, contractualize that? And yeah, again, I don't know. It might be for different markets where this is not an issue, or, you know, this will be a part of the agreements that the ISPs using this will have to work out. I don't know about that side of things, but it's certainly interesting to see them, you know, gold is distributed route, and this product is why it's called a passive network, right? Because you can just put this anywhere without power and just, you know, drag the cables from the individual clients into it, and it will just work.
All right. So they also have another switch that's 16 port, which it doesn't say whether it's PoE or not. I'm guessing it's maybe PoE.
So the gigabit one is PoE out, okay, not PoE in.
So that is PoE out, and it has two SFP plus ports.
So
which is really
this
cool.
One has to be powered.
Okay. Excellent. So this one can actually, I like the idea of that, having like a kind of a smaller industrialized 16 port PoE that's got SFP plus. That I can see myself using that, maybe in some specific applications. But then they also have an 8 port version with PoE out and two SFP plus links. All of these say very affordable. That 8 port one also has a built-in UPS battery support, it says, but the 8 port runs SwitchOS only. So for me, that's a no-go.
Yeah, that's a total no-go for me as well.
All right. So in addition to that, but hardware, they have...
I suppose it will be in a completely different pricing class because of SwitchOS.
Yeah, it's going to be very different. So then they have kind of two CPE units. One is, what are they calling that? The G-Pen itself. It's a PoE injector that can be mounted securely, it says. And then they have a G-Pen 21, which is a smart injector, which adds an SFP port for fiber to copper functionality. So I guess that's what you would put at the customer side. And then they also have gigabit Ethernet surge protectors. That's nice. It says tower, server room, both. And then the weird piece, the gigabit passive Ethernet repeater. So it looks kind of like a large Ethernet coupler. So I guess it says
so
Ethernet
it's,
extended
it's actually,
PoE passive, sorry, right?
Sorry, it's actually quite tiny. Just because you use the word large, it's actually quite tiny.
Oh, okay.
And if you look at the pictures from the MOM, you can see the RJ45 ports on the both sides of it. So you think, you know, how large an RJ45 is. This is, you know, it's fairly tiny.
What would you, is this like the size of a Matchbox car or something?
I would say like two Matchboxes, yeah.
Okay, okay. It says 1.5 kilometer long cable with PoE. So I guess you could couple enough of these together to get 1.5 kilometers.
So yeah, the plan is basically that you provide higher voltage at the site providing the PoE. So when you are using reverse PoE, you know, the power would come from the client. When you are using PoE injected from the switch, that would come from the switch. And excuse me again for a second. And so then you would basically put in these repeaters. And so what they do, you know, it's simple electrics, you know, as you go with distance, you lose power. And so these basically, from watts to amperes, you get the total wattage. So the total wattage stays the same. The power loss is calculated per a certain distance. They are saying it's 2.5 volts per 100 meters. So if you go up to 1.5 kilometers, which is, you know, 15 times 100, you possibly lose up to 37 volts. So if you start with 57 volts and you lose 37, you are still at 20 volts by the end of that 1.5 kilometer stretch of cable, which can still, you know, passively power a micro to get out the problem, because the passive microtik PoE is 8 through 20 volts, which, you know, 20V is completely fine with that. And so, yeah.
So I guess to kind of put it all together, at the CPE site, you've got the little G-Pen, and then you cable that, and then every so often, if you need to, you put one of these G-Pers in there, which will
so
repeat.
That's one thing they didn't specify, you know, what distance the G-Pers should be separated by. If it's every 100 meters, that would be quite painful, but I don't think it is. So that's one thing that wasn't really talked about. How often should you basically use these G-Per repeaters?
All right, and then ultimately it lands on the switch, and you put that back into your infrastructure and you're serving clients.
Yeah, that's it.
That's interesting, for sure. What'd you think about the MQS, the Mobile Quick Setup?
It's not a product for me, and I don't quite understand it because, again, there were little details to this. So they just said it's, I don't think it's full router OS. They said it's a little, very simple device that can just power and has some little simple administration. So please don't quote me on this. I don't know exactly, but I think this will be like with just a web interface, very simple, not really much you can do with it, other than, of course, for people that it's intended for, it should be enough. You know, for your installers somewhere on the tower, you just plug it in, power it, it broadcasts an SSID, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so it looks like, what, about the size of a pack of playing cards, maybe-ish?
Yeah, that's right. Somewhere in there. Yeah. You put a little like smaller.
You put like a cell phone booster in it. It's got a PoE out port so you can power a radio. And then they're saying with your smartphone, you can connect to the wireless on this and configure your radio. So if you're, I guess, on a tower, your installer can theoretically tweak the radio via his phone sort of thing.
Yeah, it's made to be very simple, and I suppose the use case is, you know, just get the connectivity up somehow for somebody that's sitting in an office with proper tool sets to configure what they need, and this is like your first step to, you know, to power it off, to test it, and etc. And there are lots of products like this on the market, right? There are power banks and connectors and all of that you can buy from various distributors, and like lots of people make this. So this is just one from MikroTik that has integrated Wi-Fi, and and they said specifically that it has like spacing for rubber bands, so you can just rubber band a power bank to it, and you know, there you go.
That's cool. Sounds nice. So they also announced the LoRa gateway. What did you what were your impressions of that?
So I have never messed with LoRa. So again, this is a product not for me. And I think we will see a pattern here, like, you know, us repeating that these are not really products for us, which shows us nicely the broadening of the market and the proliferation of MikroTik throughout various markets and how they want to basically expand into different areas. We need somebody that knows LoRa to talk about this.
Yeah, so LoRa is, and I'm no expert on it, but from what I understand, it's basically like sensor acquisition. So you'll have like temperature sensors or small devices like that, which will communicate through a LoRa gateway to transmit that information back to a server, right?
Yeah, it's very low powered, long range IoT, so M2M, machine to machine data transfer protocol. It's made for statistics and data collection and very low data stream or very low throughput data streams, but at very low power and very high distance.
That's cool. I did some Googling just for some LoRa sensors, and it's not the most readily available, easy stuff to just grab off the shelf and start working with, it looked like. You know, I mean, I didn't see a plethora of it out there, but I probably just don't know what I'm looking for, to be honest with you.
From what I know, these are used a lot in many different places already. Like, you know, those smart parking garages that tell you where to park or which spaces are occupied and which not, and etc. Like, there are competing solutions, but LoRa is one of the solutions that does this. Or, you know, farm sensors are just, there is, with the growth of IoT and M2M communication, this is one of the contenders for or in that space.
Yeah, I think I heard him in the presentation say something about in metropolitan areas, you know, with kind of smart meters or things watching parking spaces and stuff like that, about mounting them to light poles and stuff like that. So I could see them aiming towards municipalities or probably anybody doing large-scale SCADA acquisition, maybe petroleum, stuff like that. Be cool.
Yeah, we need somebody who knows more about LoRa to talk to us about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, there's no price associated with it. So even if we had somebody familiar with LoRa, we couldn't get an idea if this was, you know, like a disruptive product in the market price-wise, you know, anything like that.
So on the presentation, they said specifically that LoRa is expensive. And if Microtik tells you it's expensive, then you know, what do you imagine that number being? I don't know. But they said even comparing this to like getting a Raspberry and you know getting all the appropriate modules and heads and building it together, this one will still be cheaper. So you know Raspberry is like $35, and then you have the heads and modules, you know, that shouldn't be more than $50. So realistically, $85-90 for a very rough estimate.
Yeah, and it's the WAP form factor, so it's. I mean, they, and for obvious reasons, they try and reuse a lot of the same case design over and over, I guess. If you're going to make a thing, just make a whole lot of it, it's going to make it cheaper. And I like that form factor. I like the way you can mount it. I like the way it looks. Aesthetically, it's good.
From what I understand, it is actually a VAP, just with an added LoRa module.
Oh, there you go. Boom. They announced a new MUPS Pro, same form factor as the old one. 2448 volt battery support, and it says it's managed through a web interface. From what I understand, the old one wasn't web manageable, right? It was just kind of a passive device.
The old one was, I'm sorry, Microtik, but the old one was useless. it really was useless, and I have to see more material on this to know what it really does, what its capabilities really are, and web managed, I mean, come on.
Well, maybe.
Well, maybe you see, this gives me.
Pullable?
This is exactly where I was going. So this gives me an, you know, web managed. This gives me a very bad impression for what the real use of this will be. Because for me, anything like this is completely useless if I can't monitor it, if I can't gather statistics from it, if I can't properly control it. And web interface is not the way to do this. And so if it has a processor and, of course, the OS that comes with it, or is it just some, you know, small embedded Linux kernel that has nothing, if it can't run even SSH or any CLI, then will it have SNMP v3? And don't tell me v2, because v2 is not enough. You know, so I really have to see this to see if it's any more useful or not than the other device, which sadly is useless. Somebody wants to join in.
I'll bust them out. There you go. I still hear you. You still hear me, right?
Yep.
All right. Let me turn my... All right, got my video back. There we go. Visual indicator... All right, let's pick back up. All right, so next they have the power line, PWR line adds, this is interesting, power line functionality via micro USB. So the Haplite, Mini, and Map devices, supposedly you can plug it into the kind of powered USB, the little mini USB port, and then it will jump into your power line, right? Power line Ethernet,
so
thing, you can put another one somewhere else. Is that the idea?
This is actually already in RouterOS, and how it behaves is that if you have a Haplite or Mini or you know MAP, any devices with USB ports that take power over the USB port, this will actually present as an interface. So you will see a power line interface on that device. And therefore, it's like basically a power line bridge, but you see the power line interface as just another interface on a HAB Mini or MAP or whatever you have, which is quite interesting because, of course, it's also powering that device. But over the USB, you also get data transfer, and therefore, this is just another interface, and it basically gives you a really simple way to utilize these power line devices. And it also gives us a question of, correct me if I'm wrong, these are not selling yet. And we don't know how or even if they will be managed, these power line devices. So with this feature right now, it looks like they will be completely transparent pass-through devices, or at least one version or line of these devices will be completely unmanaged transparent pass-through, which is interesting because it makes it super simple, right? For again, is this a product not for us, or maybe it is for us, but it's also for people that don't understand how to configure anything. They just plug the power line stuff into two outlets, put the USB into two hub minis, and magically it just works.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. I wonder, it's probably built into the chipset of those devices, right? The Haplite, Mini, and Map, and why?
I think why there it's just data over USB.
Well, why aren't there? I mean, why are those the only models that it says are supported? Or maybe there's more. It's just it's saying that those are supported.
Well, those are the only ones that have micro USB for both power and data.
Oh, okay.
Other MikroTiks have full size USBs.
Oh, fair enough.
And they can't even be powered over the USB. So I think that's the only thing that is the limitation here is the, oh, I suppose the 411 and others also have micro USB. So it's a good question. Who knows? We'll see.
We maybe will get a message on it. You never know. That's an interesting idea. So moving on to what I thought was very interesting is the audience. It's a new access point with, it's design is moving towards the new kind of MikroTik, the sleeker look. The more it feels kind of IKEA to me, like something you'd see on a shelf, you know, at the big box store. But it's a tri-band 802.11 AC home AP with mesh functionality. So this is really shooting towards home users, right?
Well, it's hitting directly at Ubiquiti or Eero or any other, you know, mesh networking devices. There is a ton of them up there. So
yeah. So this is like, I would say a direct competitor to what the Ubiquiti Amplify stuff.
Isn't that their
home mesh product?
Yep.
Two Ethernet ports, LTE model, they're saying. So it's going to have
even to like the Google Mesh and the Google Home hubs and all of that. You know, there is really a lot of these meshed devices out there. So
I like the idea of it. I really do. I think it's a smart play because it's a market that's opening up fast, and they're going to come in cheaper than all of the competition.
What's interesting to me is that you could already do all of this with the MikroTik. I mean, of course, it wouldn't be in a sleek package and all of it packaged together, but if you got like a 533 or whatever else, you know, just plug in two 5 gigahertz card and one 2.4 card, or, you know, there's many options, or get a HAP AC Plus and stick it in like a USB, or, you know, many options. But what is nice with this is, of course, it's all packaged in one. You just buy one unit, which is in a really nice case. It's what is the term, Vive friendly or Vive approval, right?
It looks like something that belongs in the house. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And so from a software side, MikroTik doesn't even have to do anything because all of this is already in RouterOS. Even the meshing protocols, all of that is in there. What's interesting to me is if this will be like some hard-coded meshing that you can't really do anything with this, or if this really will be just a MikroTik that's with, you know, two AC Wi-Fi interfaces and one 2.4 radio, and you are done. So if you reset it to no config, it will be just like any other MikroTik, which I hope that will be the case. And then there will just be some really nice, simple interface for home users that auto magically configures all of this for them. But I really hope that we will have the access to, you know, it's just another MikroTik with multiple interfaces and I think all the magic happens in software.
I think you hit on the key thing for me is a very simplified interface for home users. I think that's where Ubiquiti, I mean, that's their claim to fame, really, is the interface is so simple and easy to use, and the Amplify interface is so easy for a home user to use. I can't imagine the MikroTik interface as it stands now, even with kind of the WebFig, the easy set stuff, being something that you could give to a grandma and have her, you know,
no chance.
You know what I mean? So it's, I just wonder if there is going to be some supplemental interface, maybe specific for this, or You know, I don't know why they wouldn't roll it across to all products, but, you know, are we going to see some kind of redesign associated with
it? I think it will be all new mobile management. I don't think Winbox or Webfig will be touched. I think all of this will go mobile, and there will be a mobile app that you just install the app, press a button, it will automatically find, pair, configure, and work. Because realistically, as soon as you have to tell users, you know, open a browser, put in an IP address, how to find out the IP address, that's too much already.
Yeah.
For that target market, that's too much. You just want one button click in an app, and that's it.
That makes way too much sense. I think you're probably going down the right street on that one. That makes a lot of sense. Well, any other last thoughts from the European mom?
Just surprise, because most of these products are not for the usual MikroTik customer base or use base. And surprise even more in the fact that there really are no new products for their core user base and customer base. And I was really surprised by that, because all of the CSS and CRS things that were in there, we already knew about. All the switches we knew about from a year ago, it's just that they haven't been delivered yet.
Yeah.
And other than those, all the products were, you know, GPEN, not really for US or European market. Yeah. All of the end user and home user stuff, all the LoRa stuff. So MikroTik is really pushing the boundaries and spreading to different markets, and it will be interesting to see what the future holds.
You know, it makes me wonder, if I come up with a very interesting product with a use case, could I sell it to them? You know what I mean? Because obviously, like the GPEN stuff, I can't imagine they just came up with that on their own. Maybe they did, but it seems like somebody probably came to them, maybe with a promise of purchasing a lot of them or something like that. But I don't know.
I don't know if MikroTik works that way. I really don't. But who knows?
No, maybe some government said, make us 40,000 anythings and we'll buy them.
Maybe. It's also interesting with the recent, which we talked, I don't know if this was on last podcast or two podcasts ago, but with the recent payouts for MikroTik vulnerabilities, which there is also theories and conspiracy theories that it's MikroTik actually paying out those bug bounties through a third party. Of course, again, none of this is confirmed and we don't really know, but the theories are that there was a really big customer, like government or a telco, that requests MikroTik to have an official paying bug bounty program, and MikroTik, being MikroTik, didn't want to do it directly, but did it through a third party. So maybe there is a way, if you are large enough and if you are connected well enough and you can convince MikroTik to do something, and if it makes financial sense to them, they will do it. And maybe the Jeeper stuff or all of this is a part of that, or maybe it's not. Who knows?
I don't know. We'll never know for sure. Let's see. So let's move on to a little bit of other industry news. I just saw that Ubiquiti on their beta store has announced a 60 gigahertz radio that's got like a 5 gig failover built in, and those are coming in at $130. So I guess that's going to be trying. I mean, it's got the failover, which is an interesting feature, right? So the MikroTik 60 gigahertz stuff only has a 60 gig radio, but it's coming. Isn't a pair like $130 for the 60 gig MikroTik stuff? I think it's somewhere around in there.
I am actually not sure.
Yeah, so I think it's like a complete. So the price of one Ubiquiti is a complete link of MikroTik, but the MikroTik doesn't have the failover, so it's something to keep in mind.
But I specifically like how the pricing is geared, like, yeah, just $10 over MikroTik. You can see the influence of MikroTik definitely, you know, at the price point. If there was no MikroTik at this price point, this would be 5 times more expensive.
I know. I think it's so funny because all the vendors are kind of close, and then MikroTik walks in, and they're that dick. And everybody's like, oh, my God, what are you doing?
They're taking all the profits from us again.
That's killer. I love it. Let's see, Fiverr Store. I got an email from Fiverr Store saying that they merged or acquired an optic factory, so their optical interfaces should be getting significantly less expensive. Their SFP pluses are like, I think the multimode ones are somewhere in the neighborhood of $15, and their single mode SFP pluses are around $20, something like that. So cheaper prices all around. It's always good.
Yeah, Fiverr Store is getting really big.
They are. It's out of control. I've been turning people onto them for ages. I've been using their kit forever, and I've never had any problems with their stuff. Let's see. Windstream is in Chapter 11 right now, but from all indications and from a few people on the Slack, they're saying that it's pretty much business as usual, and their press releases are saying everything's pretty much business as usual. So that's good. I thought that was interesting, but...
Yeah, supposedly it's just corporate restructuring, which doesn't really influence or mean anything. So
yeah, nothing to me anyway. I'm sure a bunch of lawyers are making a ton of money, but doesn't mean anything to me.
Definitely.
Let's see. Mike said, since he's not here, Wisp America is next week, and he hopes to see you guys there. I think that's all I know about that. Let's see. So a few updates from the Slack.
I think...
Go ahead.
Maybe we were supposed to mention that there is a game night or something that people are supposed to take place in.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he had details on when it was, though. So he was saying that there's a game night. I think that's going to be free snacks and beers starting at 7 and goes till at least midnight, I think. So he's planning on being there, but I'm not sure what day that is. So look out for that. It sounds
I think we have multiple people going to Wisp Americas that's from our group. So
oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, you guys avoid Mike as best you can. Good luck.
And poke him for the last podcast.
That's right. Hopefully I can get that up soon. I need to get the files from him. Let's see. The Slack updates. So if you guys aren't aware, we have a patron, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You jump in there. You become a patron and you get access to our members only Slack. And here are some of the updates from this week, or the last couple weeks, I guess, not necessarily just this week. I have been trying to, and Thomas, this is probably a good question for you, set default configs on a MikroTik. So I've got about 150 of these jokers to configure. I wrote some scripts that build all my configurations for me. And from my understanding, which is obviously wrong, is that whenever you do a net install, I mean, not only will it update router OS, but you can also stick a config on there. That works successfully. It updates the OS, it puts the config, but whenever I, hold the reset button and reboot it, it goes to just a blank configuration. I was thinking that it would replace the default, but it apparently doesn't. Am I doing that wrong?
So there is only officially two ways, how to... unofficially, there is three, but we don't have access to the third way. So there is realistically only two ways how to change the default config on RouterOS. And number one is, a net install. So any configuration you push through net install will become the default config, or at least should become the default config. There is a 100-year-old bug when if you do system print default configuration, it will print the default out of the box, but net install overrides that. You just can't see it. So that is way one. And way two is with the distributor customization package. So with the customization package, you can override like the login banner to RouterOS and other things. And a part of this customization package is you can override the default configuration.
All right. So in theory, if I net install and push config, that should overwrite the default. So even if I tell it to do a reset, I wonder why. So it's perfectly taking the configuration. I see everything in there. So I know it's working because it's configuring it. But whenever I, do the reset, the little reset dance, it just comes up blank. I have no idea why. Maybe
so
I'm doing something wrong.
You can say it's doing something because you're not getting default, you are getting blank. So
yeah.
Perhaps some investigation is in order.
Yeah, maybe it's the version of code I have loaded on there. Maybe it's something weird with that. I don't know. I'll pursue it further. I just, I haven't been down that path in a long time, so I was thinking I went crazy because it wasn't working for me. So it looks like maybe I just am. I'll try a couple of different versions and see if maybe it does it differently on there. Something else I noticed, Andrew Cox was saying a post version 642 MicroTik hotspot creates a server queue by default, and he said it messes up his user rate limits. Miller was suggesting that in his hotspots on his on login for users, he just kind of moves that down to the bottom. Have you run into that?
I have not used hotspots in a long time. I think maybe like 8 years or something. So that part of RouterOS I haven't touched for a long time.
Gotcha. I still use it just for guest access at different places to get them to accept an AUP and stuff like that. So I need to actually check on a couple of boxes now that I've read that and reread it. I probably need to get on that. Something else they mentioned at the EU MOM is that the CCRs, a couple of them have kind of been redesigned with, was it like the 1036 and maybe the 72? Now they have dual power supplies. Is that right?
Yes. Thank you, MicroTik.
Yeah. And he also noted that they've stuck a fan in between the two power supplies.
So I don't think MicroTik will admit officially, but unofficially, somewhere between 30% and 40% of CCR deaths are from power supplies. Oof. So the power supplies which are in CCRs are, let's just say, less robust than they should be. And MicroTik is now fixing that. So new revisions of CCRs will come with, well, first of all CCRs will come with redundant dual power supplies, which is a really nice thing. Awesome. And supposedly this comes without a price increase, which is even better. And yeah, MicroTik said that all of these power supplies are completely redesigned using much higher quality parts, and they have a fan in between them. So, you know, between all of those, hopefully it should eliminate all PSU-related failures. And on top of that, you have two of them. So yeah, thank you, MicroTik. Really nice job on
Absolutely.
That
Absolutely. Progress, progress. Always moving forward. Something else.
Go ahead. Sorry, there is one more important thing. Apparently you can change those PSUs for 48 volt ones.
Oh, that's right, DC. And I think, yeah. Didn't Thrift say you can mix and match?
That is not confirmed, but maybe you can mix and match positive and negative, yeah. And even mix and match, you know, 48 and 220 and all of that. But none of that is yet confirmed.
All right, well, that's cool. One more thing to add to the product feature list there. Let's see. Rob laments the fact that on some of the MicroTik switches, the top left port is port number 2. So instead of starting numbering from the top at 1 and then bottom 2, they're doing it in the reverse order. Which, if you're a Cisco guy, yeah, that kind of breaks your brain. But I think I'll adjust. I just thought that was funny.
It's super funny because all the manufacturers do it differently. Some even HP gear, within HP gear, you have some switches with start numbering at top and some switches with start numbering at bottom. Yeah. So,
yeah. I've seen some that start at the top left and move to the right in their numbering and then come back.
Oh, yeah, that's common. Yeah.
A little bit of everything. Let's see. Steve was talking
about...
We're
just waiting for that crisscross numbering now.
It's just, you know, it's random, randomized. It's
or even that,
security,
yeah,
by obscurity. You never know what port you're getting. Let's see. Steve was troubleshooting an IPsec issue with Mike, and he said, watch out for fast-tracking some IPsec traffic. He said he's been burned in the past by that, so that's something to look out for, I guess. Let's see. Somebody else, it came up, network statements in OSPF in Cisco and MicroTik. It basically tells the process to run OSPF on these interfaces, right? So it's looking at the IP, the subnet you put in there, and it's finding all the interfaces that have those in there. Subsequently, it will add those subnets into the process, right, and advertise them. But really, it's just saying run on these interfaces. I think somebody was, I don't remember why that came up, to be honest with you. It was so long ago.
So there is a few things since we are talking about this. So number one, in MicroTik, any interface that is inside of OSPF networks, it gets created dynamically. So be careful, because you might end up with a bunch of dynamic interfaces which are without any security. Because by default, the dynamic interfaces don't have security. And number two is never run NAT on an interface which is part of OSPF. that just is not a good idea.
So on the first thing you were talking about, theoretically, you could have a customer-facing interface running OSPF waiting for them to jump into your process and possibly
code and problems. Steal all of your routing tables.
Or you could take a previously configured piece of equipment and plug it in and unwittingly completely screw up your network by having it jump in. Not that I've ever done that, but I've done that before. So just be careful.
So there is a little trick you can do here. In MikroTik, in OSPF interfaces, you can do a plus, like add an interface, and there is a selector for all. And you can force the default behavior of OSPF, because if you create an interface which covers all interfaces, which this does, MikroTik will never create a dynamic interface. And as soon as an interface should be part of OSPF, it will behave basically using this default all interfaces rule, which makes it a little less prone for misconfiguration errors.
Awesome tip. So one other one is, I can't remember who asked, but they were looking for tips on finding fiber crews in the area, right? They need to run some fiber, they need to do some repairs, have some ends put on, I don't know, whatever. I've been in this pickle before, and the best way I found out is ask your local municipality, right? So the city, the county entity, those guys are generally running fiber. A lot of them are doing it for streetlights, you know, the controls on there, or water treatment plants. They're running fiber for those. Or if you've got a local power company, most of those guys are running fiber with their infrastructure. Also, if you've got a college in your town, or sometimes ISDs, if they're big enough, they'll be running a kind of a fiber network in their infrastructure and connecting their schools and things like that. So those guys, usually if you can find the IT teams in those places, they can tell you pretty much everybody who operates in your area, and maybe not everybody, but probably their most reliable vendors. So that's the first place I would go to look for anybody. Do you guys do much fiber over there in Slovakia?
Don't get me started about this rabbit hole. Basically, it's very different even across countries in EU. So in Slovakia, fiber is done completely differently than in, let's say, Lithuania or Germany or Ireland. So maybe this topic is for a different time.
Okay, we'll put a pin in it. We'll put a pin in it, because I would love to see other people's perspectives on how all of that infrastructure works. Because I know in some countries, like in New Zealand, they have those global or the national fiber networks, right, where the government actually puts all that stuff in and makes it very inexpensively available to everybody, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's some of the countries in EU do that. In other countries, it's municipalities or the local governments, down to even like the county level, that they pull their own fiber and then lease it. And in some countries, the government just doesn't give a crap, and everybody does the best they can do themselves. And in others, the government subsidizes, and you can build your own with subsidies. And so that's why I said this is really... Yeah, very mixed bag, different things in different EU states, and the answer is it just depends on where you are, and
Okay. So one more thing I wanted to talk about, and Thomas, I'm so glad you're here, because you've got a lot of inside information, a lot of expertise on this, is Bostjan. Well, let me start. I've been seeing a lot of pictures being posted. I can't remember, maybe in the Wisp Talk or Wisp Picks or something like that, some of the Facebook groups, about it's like street art and stuff like that, about how 5G is gonna give you cancer and it's killing us and stuff like that. So there's a lot of FUD right now associated with 5G technologies, and I guess the radio waves and stuff like that. And so Bostjan actually started asking questions, you know, that he's actually been hearing some things, and he was just curious about the dangers of wireless. And so a lot of people chimed in, a lot of really good information. But he kind of summarized it down into just a handful of things, which I thought was pretty funny. But you really summarized it fairly succinctly. Would you like to repeat what you feel about the dangers of Wi-Fi that we're doing?
So I think this is not a new thing, really, first of all. If you remember, there was like a big scare wave or hoaxes running around in the early 2000s about cell phones giving you cancer and holding cell phones up to your ear, getting brain cancer and stuff like that. And, you know, this is just the newest wave of, you know, 5G is dangerous and government wants to weaponize cell towers and all of that. Which I find completely ridiculous, but then again, it's conspiracy theories, and, you know, people conspiracize as they do. But yeah, to make it short, everything in the universe pretty much shines RF radiation at us. The sun itself and every single star radiates EM electromagnetic radiation across the entire frequency spectrum. And there are basically two types of EM radiation. The dangerous one, which is called ionizing, and the non-dangerous one, which is called non-ionizing. And the difference is in the energy levels. So the ionizing radiation, which is like X-rays, well, you know, even ultraviolet and many more, the high energy radiation is ionizing because it can actually ionize molecules. And if you've ever taken basic chemistry, you know that a molecule is ionized if it basically receives or loses an electron in its outer shell. The problem here becomes that when you ionize atoms, this damages DNA, because obviously DNA being a very, you know, a storage device for us humans, when you mess with that storage of information by changing atoms into different ions, you mess with DNA, and this causes mutations. This is, by the way, why after nuclear bomb explosions, you get, you know, mutations and cancers and etc., because nuclear bomb explosions produce ionizing radiation, which is the dangerous kind. What people don't usually realize is that, as I said, every single star, even our sun, produces EM radiation across the entire spectrum. So this is not nothing that's unusual, and even many processes within our planet and other planets as well produce quite a bit of EM radiation on different frequencies. So the important part is the frequency. Is the frequency dangerous or is it not dangerous, first of all? And second of all, is the transmit power. Mm-hmm. How much power are you transmitting? My example here is that, you know, you can die from drinking too much water. Like really,
yeah.
Just Google for
yeah,
it.
You can.
You will die if you drink too much water, but you will not live if you don't drink water. So here is a super simple example where too much of anything will kill you. And so when you look at non-ionizing radiation, which is all equipment that we use today as a human race uses, because, you know, killing ourselves with our own radiation, if we were to use ionizing radiation, would be bad, obviously. So we use non-ionizing radiation for everything. It is not dangerous, first of all, and second of all, there are power limits, which every single piece of equipment has to abide by law that specify how much you can transmit into the air. So I don't want to make this longer than I have to, but the point is that what happens if non-ionizing radiation strikes any object, any matter? Is it bounces off, and during that bounce, it gives off a little bit of energy. And this is, by the way, called harmonizing frequencies. So different matter has different harmonics and different harmonizing frequencies, which means different frequencies of radiation interact with it. Very good example is, for example, a microwave oven, which works on 2.4 gigahertz, and 2.4 gigahertz is the, I don't know if that's the, is it harmonizing, or what is the right name in English? Basically, it is the frequency for water, where water interacts with EM radiation at 2.4 gigahertz. And the point is that basically how microwave ovens work is that they heat up water. So you can try this at home. If you put any food in a microwave which doesn't contain water, like the, you know, any dehydrated stuff, etc., microwave oven won't heat it. And so microwave ovens really heat water. This is because of that harmonizing frequency of 2.4 gigahertz that they are using. It's all meant to work this way. So even if you transmit or stand in front of a radar dish which transmits kilowatts of power, the only thing that will really happen is it will cook you, literally cook you. You will receive heat. So non-ionizing radiation, when it interacts with matter, it produces heating inside of the matter because the radio waves or the EM waves bounce off and exchange energy, right? So there is, of course, debate of, you know, will it cook you? Well, for that, you would need multi-kilowatt transmitters and you would need to stand in front of them for really long periods. So
like reference-wise, like our radios that we're generally using, they're like 0.2-watt radios, right? And then cell phone towers are something like 20-watt radios, and then, say, broadcast AM, FM, TV radios are like 20,000-watt radios. That's why when you're on, like, a broadcast tower, you have to wear kind of a monitor, right? Because there is so much power that you have to just sort of be cautious about those things, right?
Yeah. So, first of all, the difference is orders of magnitude of power, right? Yeah, our equipment and 5G itself is so little power. For a comparison, a microwave oven uses usually around 1 kilowatt of power. There are ones which use less or more, but an average microwave oven is 1 kilowatt, 1,000 watts, and your average 5G radio is 20 watts. Which means that you can stand in front of a 5G radio on a tower for all day and you wouldn't feel anything. So the difference one is transmit power, and difference two is the kind of radiation that we are using, which is non-ionizing. And like, just if you go sun tanning on a beach in summer, you will receive hundreds time more radiation from the sun itself than you would standing in front of a salt up.
Yeah.
And
I saw a note somebody made on here. It said the most dangerous part of like WISP antennas is if they fall and hit you in the head.
Oh yeah, definitely.
that you're in far more danger of. Well, obviously if you're a tower climber, that's dangerous. But yeah, it's very low. I mean, it's not impacting to the human.
Not at all. Not at all. And if you are worried about it, just you have so many more things to worry about. The quality of food and environment and everything else has a much bigger impact on all of us than any EM radiation that we produce. Of course, speaking about non-ionizing radiation here.
For sure.
And I actually love to talk about this because when I train or when I used to train, when I had time to train, I would take you know, an hour of time of training to properly explain how the EM radiation actually works, because it's super interesting. And when you know how it works, it actually helps you configure Wi-Fi, which very rarely can you go into in-depth physics. And at the end, it helps you configure Wi-Fi. to me, that is just wonderful how knowing in-depth physics and like wave propagation principles and how the electromagnetic spectrum works and all of that. And in the end, it helps you configure Wi-Fi. And to me, I think that this is how physics should be taught in schools.
So you're basically
you know?
Saying learn physics and then you can watch videos of cats.
Yeah, exactly. And like, what is better, right? Because you go from such abstract, such very like foreign rules and principles, and in the end, it gives you a real benefit in the real world. And to me, that is amazing. And you know, that is why I love technology. Yeah. Somehow, well, sometimes
I think Wi-Fi kind of falls into that category of magic, right? Something, a technology sufficiently advanced enough, you know, that it's indistinguishable from magic. To me, it still very much feels that way. So, you know, I mean, because sometimes I break it down and I look at the router in front of me and I think, just how insane it is that we can transmit information almost instantaneously across the world through this thing wirelessly. It breaks my brain sometimes when I stop and think about that stuff.
Oh yeah, for me, a large part of it is also that wireless chips, you know, it costs $2. And if you think about it, how much does it have to do and how much does it have to know? Just from the radio side, from EM side, but not just that, from, you know, when you go a stack further or up and you get into modulation and all the modulation algorithms and all of that. And if you start thinking about how QAM, you know, QAM works and, you know, and then you get into QAM 256 and it's craziness and it costs $2.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a series of $2 chips fostered this relationship. Like, I would have never met you. I would have never become such good friends with you if not for, you know, this sort of technology. It's extremely mind-boggling. So all the people that are listening to me right now, it's all facilitated through these magic little chips that send out radio waves and accept radio waves. And it gives me the ability to earn a living and feed my family and run into people at a conference that I only ever get to see every so often. And it's so strange how these little things that probably have only existed for 50 years or something, you know, like us doing like this wireless communication. I guess we've been doing it for a long time with radio and stuff, but not really that long, just a few lifetimes. In the grand scheme of things, it's pretty new.
It's also super interesting seeing like the history of technology, how it evolved. I really like vintage computing and the old, like specifically looking at that point where computers, you know, actually transitioned from analog into digital and like seeing, because if you look at a computer today, it's an incredibly complex machine. You know, Intel CPUs have billions of transistors or any modern CPUs, not just Intel. And then, yeah, you have Wi-Fi and $2 chip doing magic and all of that. But sometimes it's really also interesting to look at that history and how it evolved and how we actually got to this point. And even that can teach you a lot of interesting stuff. And yeah, technology, it is magic at this point. It really is. You know, we all of us have smartphones, which are basically devices that allow us to access the sum of knowledge of mankind. You know, there is that joke that we have the sum of knowledge of mankind at our fingertips and we watch cat videos on it. And
or just like smartwatches. There's more compute power in that smartwatch than was required for us to go to the moon.
Oh, yeah, by orders of magnitude. Yeah,
it's mind-boggling. And we use it to make sure that we are hydrating enough. You know, it'll buzz and when it's time for you to drink a cup of water or something, you know, it's the stuff we actually use it for is kind of amusing. Or like microcontrollers, like I'll use an Arduino that, you know, I pay $1.15 for and all I use it for is to make an LED blink. You know, and there's probably more compute power in that Arduino than in the, you know, in the Apollo 13 or whatever that went to the moon. One more thing for you guys. Thomas got some really great feedback. Thank you, everybody who came up and said hello to him. Speaking of, he was there for Unimus. You guys should definitely check out Unimus. But he got some really good feedback. One of it was more enterprise networking stuff, which I love because I do a lot more enterprise stuff than I actually do wireless stuff. So if you guys are interested in that, let us know specifically what you want to hear about it. Or if you are interested in hearing more about it, just let us know that you are interested. Some of the other feedback was more international perspectives, I guess. So anybody who's in Asia, India, South America, really just, I guess, different, that have different problems. We want to hear about your problems, how you tackle those on a daily basis, or, you know, if you run into kind of situational stuff, how you would deal with that, right? I love hearing how other people accomplish their goals, even if they're similar to mine, but they go about it in a completely different way. I think it's so educational for everybody. And then also more fiber. If you guys are fiber experts, we have some guys that do fiber, but I don't know that we have any real quote-unquote fiber experts. So if you are a fiber guy, reach out to us. And if you are in an interesting region and you run into interesting problems, reach out. We'd love to be talking to you. Is that about right, Thomas?
Yeah, so basically we are looking for more people to talk to us, more hosts, more casters for the podcast. And like Greg said, enterprise stuff, fiber stuff, and for the Asia, India / South America region, yeah, the point is to see how the problems are different there and how the solutions are different there. And I think it can give us all better ideas or maybe expose us to things we haven't even heard about and might be interesting for us. And so if you are any of those three and want to join us on a podcast and talk with us, let us know. We would be happy to have you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Thomas, if people are out on the internet and they just love the sound of your voice, they can't get enough and they need to get them some more Thomas, how do they go about finding you?
So I'm pretty too easy to find. Just Google for my name. I'm on all the social platforms. I have a YouTube channel that has a ton of MicroTik-related presentations and deep dives. And, of course, there is always Unimas. So unimas.net, we have live chat on the forums. Well, check out Unimas itself. But if you want to talk to me, thomas@unimas.net or just go to Unimas and I'm there.
Yeah, and Unimas is an amazing network backup system with versioning and diffs and all the good stuff. All the things you need, it's there.
You are so underselling it. It's not about backups anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's also about configuration push as well, right?
Yeah, automation, change management, configuration auditing, and the backups.
See, that's what happens. If you make me say it, I'm going to do it wrong, right? It's the idea is you do the laundry wrong one time, and then you never have to do it again.
I see.
It's all part of my plan. And if you want to get a hold of me, greg@gregsoul.com, you can go to the website. There's a lot of good discourse in our Slack. Become a patron. We love having you guys in there. There's no such thing as a dumb question. Everybody has value. Everybody is an expert in something, whether you think you are or not, and you can add value. And we appreciate everybody who shares information in there. Also facebook.com/thebrothersofwisp, all the information that's in there. Mikey puts that stuff up. So if you hate it, blame Mike. If you just kind of don't like it, blame Mike. Nobody really enjoys it. So I can't say thank Mike. I can't go that far, but all of you listeners, thank you guys so much. I appreciate you coming back every 2 weeks. Anybody who wants to do tip videos, keep reaching out. I think I've got another one coming up next week. Anybody else that wants to pop in? I'm still trying to get people on the schedule. I really enjoy that. I don't know if anybody else is getting anything out of it, but I'm loving it. So thank you guys. Keep coming back. Questions and comments. Contact us at The Brothers Wisp. Hit us through the social media. Join us on Patreon. And thank you, Thomas, again. Bye, everybody.
We talk about see you, everyone.
Methodology, so sit back and start learning. Lighting up the tower so people can start searching. Shooting up the web in neighborhoods, net surfing. We got horrible jokes, we're loud and annoying. But we're informative facts, we're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.